This is the throne. In three simple parts dealing with this chapter, which portrays the throne room of heaven, at least in part. I want to just highlight, first of all, that one sat in glory on the throne. Then to speak of the wonder and glory around the throne. And then thirdly, to speak of worship and glory to him upon the throne. There is one, we are told, who sat in glory on the throne. Your version may or may not indicate very slightly that there is a peculiarity here. We have to virtually put in the word one. There is one who sat on the throne. We have to put someone in there. It wasn't really written like that in the first place. It doesn't really say that there was someone on the throne. It says rather sitting or sat on the throne. It is implied, of course. That's why we put it in there. But it is a reflection, I think, just to bear this in mind as we go along. It is a reflection of John's great care over speaking of God. It is speaking of God, surely. But he would sooner simply speak of the throne and the implication of the God who sits on that throne, who rules from that throne. The implication is there. But this is almost all that he can bear to say. And I trust that we'll see why as we go further. There is that one who is on the throne. What does it tell us about him? Further on, we learn of the creatures around the throne. And it sets me thinking, I wonder how we ourselves will behave in heaven, if we are God's people, of course, that would be the place he would take us. How would we behave? Well, I don't know that we are really told in detail. But what we are told in this passage is that there will be this central focus of all who are around that throne, that central focus on the throne, towards him. I suspect that the best way to describe what heaven will be like is that we'll be living in a perfectly balanced busyness in God's business, living for him. There will be things to do in this new heaven and new earth. But through it all, it will be as the writer to the Hebrews speaks about the way that we live even now. It is to have our eyes set on Jesus. But through everything, that will be where our minds and our heart will be devoted. That's what's portrayed here. The lives given fully to his worship in our living, in our service. And that's what these symbols also tell us. Very briefly, John offers symbols of richness and beauty and brilliance of that one on the throne and of the throne itself and all that surrounds it. There are a couple of names of stones, precious stones being given. But those who have pursued the study in more detail, even they cannot be altogether specific about what is referred to here. And I think that's a good thing. Because it's not for us to treat these as with specific symbolism, that maybe their color means something or other. I don't think that's what it's about. John is saying, here is one who was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance. Even the rainbow around the throne was in appearance like an emerald. He was attempting to get somewhere near a description of these things. He was not intending to make it precise and specific. It's all about trying to just throw out the beauty, the brilliance, these gemstones sparkling, as it were, in the brightness. It's indescribable and it's full of glory. That's what John is spreading out for us, just in a few words, but that's as far as he can go. I know what he feels like when you're trying to describe something that you can't reach and you have to stop. You can't go any further. So in just one verse, he tells us he was like this in appearance. There was this rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald. Notice too, when he talks about the thrones, the 24 elders around the throne, the one throne, they were there serving and worshipping him. Look at them. They were not on that throne, but they had golden crowns. They were there as his servants. Later on in the chapter, it tells us that they cast their crowns before his throne. And it's to tell us again in another way of the great glory of this one who is there. If that is the level these elders were at, how much more then the king over them? There is that rainbow around the throne. Again, an attempt to try and speak of something of its appearance, and again, a brightness and a brilliance about it. Does the rainbow remind us of the saving God, covenant God of Noah? It belongs to him. There are two more things that we learn, and I am going through it very quickly. There are two more things in verse 5 that we learn concerning the throne, and it tells us that from that throne proceeded lightnings, thunderings, and voices. They signify the throne as a source of strength and of majesty. Remember how the Psalms speak of great sounds that can be heard in creation and tell us that these are nothing beside the voice of God. Again, it's telling us there's this just accumulation. That's the source, that's the place that the voice comes from. You must pay attention. And then, too, there were the burning lamps, seven of them, which are, we are told, the seven spirits of God. Burning, constantly burning, the word means it's always there. It is before the throne, it is near that throne. As for the seven spirits of God, what's meant by this? It was touched on, it was used in the first chapter in verse 4, where the seven spirits of God is bracketed by the Father and the Son. It is the Spirit of God himself, although perhaps the peculiar expression, seven, which reappears constantly through Revelation. It's a great sign and symbol of perfection. These are the things that we may take from this. It was a brilliant place because of the brilliance of the one on the throne. John doesn't take long there, does he? There's more perhaps said of Solomon in all his brilliance. But John describes so little of this king, I think because the king is so great. Instead of that, he turns to register what it is that surrounds the throne, and then what is done towards that throne. Those two are pointing to give us an understanding of who it is there. I've touched on one of them a moment ago about those elders as they later on fell before him and worshipped him. Some of the things that are done around that throne and what is around it. So there is that one on the throne. There is wonder and glory around the throne. Let me come back then to these 24 elders in verse 4. They were on thrones as well. Thrones, seats of honor. But they were around his throne. He was at the center, at the heart. Who exactly are the 24 elders who occupy them? Well, there will be writers who will be well occupied in trying to explain who they are. And there's a variety of suggestions. But it doesn't tell us very much about it, does it? It's just passed over. They are there. But they are people in a place of great honor. Some would say they were angels. Some would say they represent leaders and the heads of both the Old Testament and New Testament Israel. We don't know. We're not told those things. What we can say is that they are high representatives of the created order, and particularly of men, God's people. They are the elders. It's a word that is used in the church. They're high representatives. They're also holy. They're in white. Remember the letter to Sardis? Where those who would endure, those who would overcome, would be clothed in white garments. Here are some in white. And in all their holiness, in all their brightness, in all their honor, with the golden crowns and on thrones. Remember that their eyes are set on the one great throne. Yes, look at them, but look at what they're doing and follow their eyes. If their eyes are set on that throne in the midst of them, who then is he who sits there? And so there were the elders. He tells us also that before the throne in verse 6 was a sea of glass like crystal. And again, this is the best way of writing out in English what is said there. Beyond them is a sea. At least this is how John describes it. Do remember through all of this that John says in verse 2, I was in the Spirit. It is a spiritual perception of these things above all. And there was that sea that he saw. What I find most helpful in this is to remember what it's said much later on about the sea, chapter 21. At the beginning it says there was no more sea. And I think the sense of that is that the separation between people, the context there, speaks of pain that people suffer in different ways. And sea is such a successful, powerful separator. And separation is crucial for holiness. There's the throne, and before the throne, around the throne, is the sea. And I think the measure of separation is indicated here because of the holiness of the one in the midst. But as well as that, I think John is desperately trying to describe something of real beauty, something amazing. He says it was like crystal, and this is an attempt to describe in his day, apparently, glass, and I have seen one or two examples, and it's very smoky and thick looking. Even the finest stuff, it's got, you can't see through it, unless somebody was able to afford a fortune. And I think it speaks of the scarcity and the cost, just to heighten the excellence of what is here around the throne. That's his description, his attempt to describe it and to portray it to simple men like ourselves. Again, portraying the sense of grandeur in this setting. And it's that sea of real beauty. My mind goes to sometimes on a glorious day and you look out over a lake or over the sea and you see the sun sparkling on the water. It's that and more, because it marks out the presence of that great throne in the midst of heaven. But also around the throne were four living creatures, full of eyes in front and in back, indicating their awareness and their attention to all that is going on. And these four creatures do fascinate many people when you come to Revelation, along with the other beasts that we come across further on. What may we learn from these? Again, very briefly. Notice, first of all, that only once But once they were told, we are told, they were in the midst of the throne. That same throne tells us they were there. Perhaps it is pointing to their honor. Perhaps the most helpful suggestion, I think, is that we can realize that it's from there that they were sent to do the Lord's will. It's from him that they were to go out, and they were his workers. I think we may conclude that they were cherubim. It is very similar words that are used in Ezekiel chapter 10, and it tells us about a living creature who was a cherubim. Cherubim being one of the great of the angels. Also to take note of their song in verse 8, as we read in Isaiah chapter 6, a very similar song to the seraphim there. But yet you might say, well, if they're angels, why do they have this appearance? One like a lion, one like a calf, a face like a man. The other was like a flying eagle. Well, again, do notice that use of the word like. Again, I think we do need to bear in mind that John was attempting in some way to describe, according to the things that we do know, to describe things that perhaps we will never grasp until we see them for ourselves, and even then perhaps not. I think my understanding would be that they are meant to bring to mind again, to represent the world of all creatures. There are different ways that you could apply some of these things, perhaps in detail. But they do describe the whole of the created, of the animal world at least, and representing the created order. Again, brought before the throne of their Maker, around the throne. I have mentioned Ezekiel. It is useful to be aware of the scenes in the prophets, particularly Ezekiel and Daniel, that similar language is often used here in Revelation. And I hope to provide some more of that as we do go further through the prophecy. I do that not because some people seem to suggest that John was perhaps studying that and he came up with something like Revelation. That cannot be. But he was a man who was steeped in the scriptures. Those would be things that were very, very much alive to him. And as he saw things that he was attempting to describe, that kind of language would be entirely suitable. And so it was portrayed here. And so there are these things that may be seen around the throne. Amazing things. Things that heighten the glory of that throne that is there in their midst. A further demonstration of the glory of the one who sat upon the throne. And out of them comes worship. It's not just the things that can be seen, but these wonderful and glorious things, the creatures and the elders particularly, they then turn. They're not just living there, being there, but they're there actively worshiping God. They give worship and glory to him who is on the throne. It begins with the living creatures. In verse 8, the second part, they do not rest day or night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." I've suggested earlier that John finds it difficult to describe this one on the throne. But he treasures the word of the creatures who did worship him. He records there, as he does also in verse 11, the song, or the saying, but possibly the song, lifted up to this one upon the throne. That last sentence, who was and is to come, is even in English, it's perhaps not the best of grammar, but what does grammar matter when it gets the point across? It's very forceful, isn't it? It's the always one, who was and is to come. It's so plain, the eternal one, who always was, who is to come. and it is something that he picks up and develops himself. He repeats it several times, describing this one who sits on the throne. He's the one who lives forever and ever. Although as I was looking at this and I remembered the connections and the use of language from Daniel and so on, I was remembering that when Daniel himself and his friends and others approached the king of their time, do you remember what they would say? The way they introduced their address to the king? They would say to Nebuchadnezzar or one of the other kings of Persia or someone, O king who lives forever. And I wonder if John maybe did have that in mind. It's him that says this in verse 9. He uses these words also in verse 10. This one who lives forever and ever. He's picked up on this and he's driving it home. This is the one that we're dealing with. The one who was and is to come. And then when the living creatures have done this, whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to this one, then the 24 elders, the representatives of God's people, also turn to his worship. They fall down before him. This action seems, I think, more than a simple decorous bow that the high and mighty might give to a king. It's more like John's falling at his feet as one dead in chapter 1. And they cast their crowns before his throne. They worship also. Truly he is the king over all. All crowned heads will worship him. And they tell us why. They tell him why. You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created. That telling of his eternity that I've mentioned three times from verse 8 to 10, we need to feel that emphasis. We do need to feel it. We need to know it. We do know it. It's words that we're familiar with. They're in our heads. We need to also feel it. Remember that this was revealed in a day like our own. The church was suffering. You only have to read those seven letters. And many in such a situation may have been liable to ask, will it ever end? Will we last? Will we endure? There may be others outside the church who would say, you are not going to last. Well, here is a precious ministry of God in his grace to his people, that he shows this view of his throne, a reality that is hidden otherwise until due time, so that his people will know him in his glory, in his eternal majesty. To see and to hear that our God, who has brought us into his church, yes, he's also the one that we can call Father. He is this one. This one who lives forever and ever. Not just a king of Babylon. Where is Babylon today? The world might try and pressure God's people to think otherwise of God. Come back to this throne. He is the one who was and is to come. He is the one who lives forever and ever. It needs to be repeated. It needs to be driven home. And it's because of this that then the elders, this is a portrayal of the things that are to take place. And they talk about what took place at the beginning of man's experience of God. They talk about this creative work of this God. He is worthy of worship. He is worthy to receive glory and honor and power. And you might say, as a good theologian, surely these things are his already. But it is still important to say it because man wants to take these things for himself. We're not worthy. He is. That they should all be his and recognized as such. They are rightfully his. And these reasons are then given for, because you are worthy, because you created all things. This reason struck me as being so politically incorrect, it's exciting. The world will not have it. But this is the fundamental reason. It's because he created these things that he has then gone out in redemption also. He wants these things for himself. The nations, he's got his eyes on the nations. We sang earlier, you created all things. In the throne room of heaven, there is no question, no qualification. All things exist and were created by his will. He did it. He's worthy. He is the one who is lifted up. But I must close. And so what now? Let's be excited by these things. But what now? Well, can anyone else tell you or show you the things which must take place after this? Because that's what John is telling us. That's what he was shown and what he has recorded. And who doesn't look ahead at all in their lives, even a day ahead? Well, we are told what must take place after this. And what we find is as John goes in and there's more to happen, there's a great deal to be unfolded and revealed, but this is where it starts. This is in existence already. This is the one who was and is to come. If you want to look ahead at all, find out, understand what must take place after this in your life or in anybody else's life in this world. Make this your starting point. And as you make this your starting point, I just plead with you that, well, you might say, well, he hasn't answered all my questions. I'm not going to try. I want you to get a sense of the overwhelming that I think John is trying to convey here. There's a breathlessness about it. He's got to move on, and he can only tell us those in some way. It's like that. But I can't say any more. It's just not possible. And here as well, that unapologetic worship of the creatures and the elders, and there are more to follow as we read on. They do it with no hesitation, no apology, because they know he is worthy, he is holy, and they tell it forth as it is. And because of that, get your confidence here. For now, find it in him. And let me just suggest too, that when it does come to thinking of heaven, make sure this is your starting point. Not, I wonder what it will be like for me. Think about the God who's there, over all things, the one who is in the midst of that throne, high and lifted up, one that we can't describe, one in glory on the throne. May it be to his praise. So let us pray together.